From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone and Bob Garfield are both off this week. I'm Mike Pesca. There's a type of candidate who engenders a particular type of coverage, the candidate the media loves to love.
He's nowhere right now, but he's going to seem quite impressive to, I think, a fair number of voters.
He's a guy who's doing things differently. He's got some very progressive ideas about where to take the Republican Party.
People want to come, see him in action, talk to him, touch him.
This object of the media's affection frequently exhibits a civility and willingness to compromise, which the most Machiavellian among us might note are fine virtues for one's enemies to have. The candidate the media loves to love will not be afraid to rip into his own party, but be genteel when it comes to party stalwarts of the opposite stripe. In the 2008 election, John McCain at least began his campaign as the media candidate. This time around, it's the former governor of Utah.
I'm John Huntsman, and I'm running for president of the United States. Thank you all.
Being the media-besotted candidate may not be a great position for a Republican in this age of brickbats and Breitbarts, and Huntsman seems to sense this. He's walked back some of the positions which got him called sensible in the first place. For example, he now says it's not the right time for the cap-and-trade policies he once supported. Also, while he took stimulus money as governor of Utah, he now says he doesn't think the stimulus worked well. Slate's Dave Weigel says Huntsman's supposed moderation, while loved by the media, will be seen as a vice in the eyes of Republican voters, especially the ones from states that hold early caucuses and primaries.
It's something that's not comprehensible, possibly, for liberal voters or for independent voters. Conservative voters are convinced, one, that the media is set against them, and two, that the media was responsible and culpable in helping elect Barack Obama, who they consider not just a failure of a president, but somebody who was sold to them in an unfair, dishonest way. That's where I start when discussing Huntsman. These people do not like the fact that he is so warmly spoken of on morning talk shows.
Now, is this the most of the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, or just the people who make the most noise?
Well, the people who make the most noise, but Iowa's caucus system is designed for noisy people. He has basically punted on Iowa. I mean, Huntsman said before he got into the race that he didn't think he'd compete there, that he thought he could really make his stand in New Hampshire.
I know that there's always been that bumper sticker that says a variation of piss off the New York Times, vote Republican. But especially in this day and age with issues of unemployment and all these wars that we're engaged in, do you think having a loathing of the media is going to be anywhere near the driving force that it has been in the last few elections for Republicans?
I think a bit more, actually, because, again, Republicans feel like the country was sold a bill of goods by Barack Obama. Look, you can't talk to Republican voters or even independent voters who are going Republican and come away with anything other than the idea they're very concerned about the economy. And because of that, they're willing to accept a lot from a candidate. But they're also very concerned about nominating somebody who saw early on the mistakes that liberals were making. Now, that doesn't all transfer onto Huntsman. It's just that Huntsman begins this with an appeal to reporters, and they're using that very well. I mean, there are lots of governors of states that only have two or three members of Congress, and not all of them are taken seriously as presidential candidates. He is taken seriously because of his appeal to the media. Go ahead.
And his appeal to the media because of his biography, which includes that he served in the Obama administration, that he took stances that would be defined as moderate among Republicans.
The importance of John Huntsman as a national figure rests entirely on this period between the election of Barack Obama and when Huntsman was selected as ambassador to China. And, you know, Huntsman is on the record at the time saying what he would, I think, still say were pragmatic things, saying that the stimulus bill should have been larger or should have been more targeted. But basically, the idea of a big stimulus bill is not bad. And if he actually runs a campaign dedicated to changing the way voters think about this, that'd be one thing. So far, he isn't really doing that. When he's pinned down on his previous positions, he finds a way to pivot to someone else. Now, the things he's flip-flopped on, I think, are incredibly unconvincing. When he talks about that greenhouse gas initiative, it's a lot like when Romney talks about his Massachusetts healthcare plan.
So you think the media is writing the Huntsman story as if he still is the moderate guy, when they should in fact be writing the Huntsman story as Republican candidate announces currently has, you know, 95% of the stated doctrinaire Republican views?
Well, yeah, but he's trying to be unspecific, and you can get very far by being unspecific.
Do you think Washington reporters in general like apostate Republicans more than they like apostate Democrats?
I actually think we're equal opportunity fans of apostates. you know, in the Senate, you can notice the biggest clouds of reporters are around people like Lindsey Graham, who we know are going to say critical things of the party leadership, who might align themselves with the president on some foreign policy issue. And they're also around people like Ben Nelson and Joe Lieberman. And again, this race kind of lacks, the Republican race kind of lacks a candidate who will go at Republicans on some of the truths they all believe. It's a bit odd because in other countries that have similar economic problems, no one has just our economic problems, there's a lot of truth-telling going on about what we need to do to get out of this mess. Truth-telling about what benefits we need to give up or what taxes we need to increase.
So it just may be the case that the coverage of Huntsman, the favorable coverage of Huntsman is the candidate that we want to see, this truth teller. It's not really Huntsman, but, you know, he comes closer than anyone else.
I think the media is desirous of that. A lot of people are desirous of that.
Dave Weigel is a political reporter for Slate.com. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Conventional wisdom says that John Huntsman is still very much a long shot. The conventional wisdom also says the Republican field is uninspiring, though the conventional wisdom adds that President Obama's re-election chances will be tied to the economy. Hey, just who or what is coming up with this conventional wisdom, and do they get paid by the platitude? It's a weird thing about conventional wisdom. On the one hand, conventional wisdom is usually derided. On the other hand, according to the Washington Post's Dana Milbank,
I guess 90% of the time the conventional wisdom is correct.
Conventional seems not a very nice thing to call wisdom, but that wasn't always the case. Despite the intentions of John Kenneth Galbraith, who did mean for the term to be pejorative when he coined it in 1958, conventional wisdom was pretty soon seen as a good thing. At the time, the Random House Dictionary defined it as prudence. Franklin Foer of the New Republic points out that was during the time when the conventional wisdom and the very few men who created it were quite respected.
There was a golden age of conventional wisdom where you had these pundits, the Alsops, Walter Lippmann, David Broder, issuing these judgments that were reflective of a broad set of thinking among the political class.
But in the last decade, the internet-aided diffusion of news created a need. Someone who could collect and essentially bottle the conventional wisdom so that all the people in the know would know what all the other people knew. First, there was ABC's The Note, which concocted conventional wisdom as it chronicled it, says Franklin Foer.
It was meta-conventional wisdom. It was very self-conscious about its aspirations to becoming a purveyor of conventional wisdom.
Created by Mark Halperin, one of the Note's constructs was the Gang of 500, bigger than a battalion, smaller than a brigade. Halperin says he invented the concept as a sort of personification of that elusive phrase, conventional wisdom.
There's still an extraordinary amount of influence that is in the hands of a very few number of people, mostly in Washington and New York, a few in Los Angeles, and a few other places. But the conventional wisdom set by the Gang of 500 is still a huge driver, not just of news coverage, but of political reality.
The Note had a particular style. Foer calls it self-conscious. Dana Milbank says,
the Note was much more sort of an act of ego and sort of saying why its authors were much smarter than the rest of us.
There was the instance in 2004 when the Note declared the presidential election was John Kerry's race to lose. This was before the Republicans even had their convention. That prediction drew attention, but it was never absorbed into the conventional wisdom. ABC still has a Note, not written by Halperin, who works for Time magazine, where he has a political tip sheet, not called The Note. The new Note is Politico's playbook, the creation of Mike Allen. Republican consultant Mark McKinnon paints playbook as stunningly influential.
I guarantee you that 99% of Washington, D.C., that's the first thing they read every morning, and everybody reads it. So everybody's sort of context for the events of the day are set by Mike Allen. I mean, that guy has more power than anybody in Washington, more than any senators or elected officials. It's remarkable.
Playbook is seen as straighter than The Note was, a reflection on the former Eagle Scout, Allen. Allen dodges, very politely, all attempts at a larger analysis of Playbook. In fact, he answered three of the five questions I asked him with the phrase, what it tries to do, as in,
what it tries to do is look ahead to what's going to happen. So it's not a news summary, but what it tries to look ahead to what people are going to be talking about that day. What's going to be on the cover of Time magazine next week? What am I thinking about if I'm thinking about the Sunday New York Times, if I'm booking packages for a network, what am I thinking about?
And of course, by programming these old repositories of the conventional wisdom, Playbook is supplanting them. As ubiquitous as Playbook is, Franklin Foer says it epitomizes the retreat of conventional wisdom away from an area where it was once needed.
It's about process in Washington. It's about the raw stuff of politics. It's not about policy in the way that a Joe Alsop column or a Walter Lippmann column or often a David Broder column were. It does reflect conventional wisdom. It is conventional wisdom, but it's not powerful in the way that old conventional wisdom was, in the way that old conventional wisdom aspired to shape not just political perceptions, but actual policy choices.
Halpern explains this as a reflection on the political culture, which itself is less interested in problem solving unless the problem is how to hurt the other party. There's not a lot of social incentive to come up with the wisest policies. Hey, the billion-dollar media idea of the day gives you status updates, not idea updates. The need for the type of conventional wisdom concerned with status accelerates as the market for measured policy solutions evaporates. At least I think that's the case. I can't be sure until the conventional wisdom shows up in my inbox or RSS feed. Coming up, a journalist living a lie comes clean. But that puts his former employers in a tough spot. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world, and the connections between them on newsstands, iPhone and iPad, and at The Economist Online. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Mike Pesca. This week, Jose Antonio Vargas, a young but accomplished journalist, took to the pages of the New York Times Magazine to reveal something about himself. Vargas is in the United States illegally. The story details how Vargas learned of his immigration status at the age of 16 and how he managed it for the last 14 years. Vargas was a staff reporter for the Washington Post, where he was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize in 2008. But when the Post backed off plans to run his revelation, Vargas offered the story to the Times magazine, which snatched it up. Times magazine editor-in-chief Hugo Lindgren says since the story was compelling and held up to fact-checking, the author's credibility wasn't an issue.
That's something that's come up today. You know, people say, you know, you lie about one thing and people can't stop lying if they do that. And I think some of that misses the point. This is not unprecedented in journalism. This is not the first person who's ever told a lie who then goes on to write about it.
Phil Bronstein has more ambivalent feelings. Bronstein was the editor-in-chief of the San Francisco Chronicle, where Vargas worked from 2000 through 2004. Vargas visited with Bronstein a few days ago.
Jose, who I really like and I consider a friend, nonetheless basically told me the day before he came out in this article, look, I did this story when I worked for the Chronicle about illegal immigrants in the Mission District of San Francisco buying fake driver's licenses at the same time that he had a driver's license, which he obtained with phony documents. So there's a fundamental conflict there where, you know, full disclosure would normally be required. But since no one but Jose knew about it, it wasn't required and we didn't get it.
But did Jose say at the time that he didn't want to report on such issues that there would be a conflict?
He said that he himself decided at the time that was just too much of a conflict and he wasn't going to report on it again. So I'm not sure he recused himself from covering that topic entirely. And it's a very slippery slope because what's he going to tell his editor? I don't want to do immigration stories anymore. That generally is not a very popular kind of approach when you're a young journalist.
In the piece, Vargas is advised by one of his many mentors to compartmentalize his immigration status. Now, as an editor, is a reporter's ability and willingness to compartmentalize that sort of, you know, huge lie, does that give you pause overall?
Of course. I think of the word compartmentalizing with rationalization. I mean, I think there may be good compartmentalization, but normally when you hear it, it's associated with somebody trying to rationalize something that is a little shifty. I think Jose probably could not compartmentalize. Say, look, he's a fabulously talented journalist. Anyone who's worked with him would agree. But there's the 800-pound gorilla in the room, you know, without anybody knowing it was there. I think that we all look back on it and wondering what we would have done differently.
Maybe that's why Jack Schaefer of Slate says that his inconsistency invites further speculation. There's something about this guy, this is Jack Schaefer already, something about this guy to make a journalist's nose itch. Did you have that itchy feeling?
I do, and my inclination is not to want to have it because I know Jose and I've followed his career over the years and I have, you know, advised him on occasion. But I think that he is a consummate self-promoter. That's one of the ways that he was able to survive, you know, with this sort of big secret hanging over him. You know, Phil Bennett, the former managing editor of the Washington Post, did not agree with Marcus Sprockley, the current editor of the Post. Phil thought that it was a courageous thing to do, that it was very troubling that he lied to people at the Post and elsewhere, but that, you know, this was the right thing for Jose to do and there was a greater good involved.
I would just submit that there are understandable or even laudable stances for individuals to take that would at the same time also disqualify them from being journalists, no?
Yeah, and I think that Jose has disqualified himself from being a journalist. He's now an advocate. So at a minimum, I wouldn't hire him. I mean, I couldn't hire him because
right.
We now know he's undocumented, but I wouldn't hire him even if he wasn't undocumented. Certainly not to write about immigration.
As editor, did you ever go through a Jason Blair or Janet Cook type situation?
Yes. Plagiarism issues come up relatively regularly. You know, which is worse for journalism, a plagiarist or somebody like Jose who's lying about his residency? I think probably plagiarism would still be seen as the more egregious sin in our profession.
When Jose came to you and talked to you, did it bring up any of those issues for you just emotionally, the personal feeling of being had and being lied to?
I was emotional when he told me, and I was torn between being irritated that he hadn't told me the truth and trying to understand what his life was like. You know, he's here at 12. He didn't bring himself over. He discovers at 16, according to his essay, that he's illegal, and decides to try and earn his way into citizenship, which, of course, was an absurd concept. But if you're 16, you know, maybe that's what you think. So I felt that there was a potential higher purpose involved here. I kind of understood that there were circumstances that I couldn't fully understand myself, given my life experience. As a journalist myself, I mean, I was trying to apply that notion that you keep an open mind about things.
There very well could be collateral damage because established journalism institutions lent him their credibility when they gave him a byline. And places like you and the Philadelphia Daily News and the Washington Post are now going to come under fire because of who he is and what he did. Do you think Jose understands that?
I think he does understand that. The one person who he told at the Washington Post, the training editor there, Peter Pearl, knew the secret and kept it to himself. And yesterday, the Post very ominously said what they thought Peter Pearl did was wrong. So I think that if there's any kind of media roadkill in this story at the moment, assuming Jose doesn't get deported tomorrow, it could be Peter Pearl, which is a shame.
Thank you very much, Phil.
You're welcome.
Phil Bronstein is the editor at large for the San Francisco Chronicle. A postscript. After our interview was recorded, Julie Mose of the Poynter Institute reported that Vargas wrote about immigration issues for the Chronicle more often than the one instance Phil Bronstein mentioned. After the false driver's license story, Vargas also reported on a Latino protest over a driver's license bill and the difficulties gay immigrants had in obtaining citizenship. This week, President Obama signed executive orders that set down the rules of war for cyber attacks. The new Pentagon guidelines are similar to those that govern the use of other weapons of war, like nuclear bombs and drone attacks. Jim Lewis is a director at the Bipartisan Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says that while the actual threat of cyber warfare has been widely exaggerated, many countries around the world are adopting policies to combat such attacks.
We just did a survey at CSIS that found about 35 countries are developing military doctrine for cyber attack, and part of that doctrine will be taking out other computers. What the Pentagon won't be doing is they won't be taking out computers in the United States, and they won't be taking out computers that belong to criminals or spies.
So do these new guidelines actually preclude the United States from doing anything?
Not at all. Hopefully they make it clear to our opponents, if you do an attack that causes physical damage or that hurts Americans, we will respond with military force. And that's a useful thing to let people know.
So the guidelines are as much about what the United States won't do as what will constitute a cyber attack on the United States?
Yeah, it's more to lay out for the world how we're thinking about this in military terms. And DOD has put a lot of effort into this over the last few years. They call it a new domain for warfare. But when they say that, what they mean is this is another way to fight, and it's subject to the same rules we apply to any other kind of weapon system. What this lets us do is it helps us prepare, one, for upcoming negotiations in the UN, where people want to talk about what are the rules for cyber warfare. And it helps us work with our allies and partner countries to say, what are the things that we want to cooperate on? What are the messages we want to send to potential opponents? And finally, it lets us talk to potential opponents. It lets us both warn them, don't do this or there'll be big trouble. And it lets us say, maybe we can sit down and talk. And DOD and state and other agencies have been making a real effort to engage both China and Russia to get cyber warfare under control.
You mentioned the UN. Is the momentum internationally to have more restrictive rules about what superpowers can and can't do in cyberspace?
It's really interesting, and there's been one big change. Most countries are afraid of cyber warfare. That's good. When everyone has a shared fear, there's a place to negotiate. But until recently, most countries, when you ask them, what nation do you fear most in cyberspace, they said the United States. We did the poll again recently, and the numbers had changed. China and Russia were in first place, and people still are concerned about Cyber Command. They'd still like rules for cyber warfare, but they're no longer as afraid of the U.S. as they once were.
The cyber attacks that you say actually have happened, including Stuxnet, what exactly was Stuxnet? Remind us.
Stuxnet was really cool. Somebody did a great job. They did a tremendous amount of intelligence work to figure out what control system ran the Iranian centrifuges that were making uranium for their nuclear weapons. The centrifuges were connected to control devices, sort of simple computers, and someone found a way to penetrate these Iranian computers, which were supposedly insulated from the internet, to create a virus that went in and caused them to go out of control and self-destruct. They had a virus that went around the world searching for Iranian centrifuges. Many countries were infected, but the only place where there was damage was Iran. So it was the most sophisticated cyber attack we've seen. And fortunately for right now, only four or five countries can do this kind of thing.
Did it really set back Iranian nuclear capabilities?
That's what we're told. Really, the debate was over, should we have an airstrike or should we use this more clandestine means? And this was infinitely better. No civilian casualties, no pictures of burning buildings on television. But that's where at least one country, Israel, was beginning to think, they're getting too close, maybe we should do something hard to them. And we all have suspects. I mean, Israel and the U.S. are the lead suspects. There are other countries that could have done it as well. But this was a military action that was very effective.
The way you characterize Stuxnet, that actually strikes me as a little bit different from a lot of the coverage, which is to worry about what does this mean for the future of worms and cyber warfare. But if you look at it like you did, this is a lot better than sending a B-2 bomber.
Yeah. You know, the problem is that we tend to call everything a cyber attack. So a group of bored teenagers go after Visa's public website. That's a cyber attack. Well, no, it's not a cyber attack. Cyber attacks are really hard. What I worry about is when the capability to launch these sophisticated attacks becomes more readily available, and when you see countries like Iran itself or North Korea or groups like Al-Qaeda, when they get these capabilities, we're going to have a big problem. But right now, it's just the top of the league that can do this, and it takes a lot of effort, a lot of time, and a lot of money.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Jim Lewis is a director at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. This week, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, decided to increase the number of possible endings for website addresses. There are currently 22 available extensions called generic top-level domains. They include .com, .gov, .org, you know them. With the new rules, companies and individuals are no longer limited to those 22 choices. President of ICANN, Rod Beckstrom, says the decision will, quote, unleash the global human imagination. In terms of branding, the possibilities are endless. For example, Mac could use iPod.apple. Citibank could be city.bank. But it comes at a price. The initial cost to own one of these top-level domains is $185,000 plus an annual fee of $25,000 to maintain the domain. For some, it's an exciting moment in internet history. For others, meh, no big deal. Ryan Singel is a staff writer for Wired.com. Ryan, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
What is it, the biggest, most glorious change ever or a snooze?
It's going to land right in the middle of those two.
It always does!
I know. I wish I could follow Rod Beckstrom's excitement that this is going to be, you know, the biggest world-changing moment since the invention of email, but that's just not the case. It's going to be interesting. We're going to see some fun new things, but we're still all going to love .com addresses.
Why do we need to expand the number of domains? Is it like you have to keep adding area codes because there's not enough numbers to go around?
There's still plenty of names you can get, but it's hard to get a good .com name. You know, think if you're a restaurant in, say, New York City, and you happen to be Mom's Cafe. How many Mom's Cafes are there in the world? So you can't get momscafe.com. So the idea is that, you know, maybe somebody would go and buy .nyc, and then, you know, if you're Mom's Cafe, you could choose to be momscafe.nyc.
But do people really still use the addresses, or do people just use search engines, you know, specifically Google, and kind of bypass actually putting in www.whatever.whatever?
Yeah, there's so much of our navigation these days happens just straight through search engines. But names still count. You know, it's nice to have a cool domain name. You know, we still see them on advertisements. So, you know, we might start to see some interesting ones that are more memorable. City.bank, the example you used, is pretty memorable. Instead of trying to remember if it's citibank.com, but your point is well taken.
So is ICANN presenting this as a possibility to raise money for themselves, or because they're serving some sort of either want or need?
They're positioning it more as like a kind of a want or need and a way to make themselves more international, because these names don't necessarily have to be in English script. These days, there's a huge number of languages that you can have domain names in. So, you know, the new extensions could well be in Greek or, Cyrillic.
But the one thing this doesn't change or address is the supremacy of the dot itself. Will we ever get to a time when the dot doesn't rule over domain names with its iron but little tiny little fist?
Generally, if there's not a dot, you're generally looking for something local on your own computer or on the little sub-network that you're on. So that .com sort of tells your computer and that you're actually looking for something on the greater internet. So that dot is never going to go away, even if, you know, its old cousin www did go the way of the dinosaur.
I remember, you know, a decade ago that the thought was the domain name was going to be so important. And of course, there was squatting. You know, since then, I was trying to think if the names were so important. I was just going through some of the names that should be out there. Sports.com, I have no idea what that is. Business.com, I don't really know what that is. I thought that was supposed to be worth a lot of money. I've read that sex.com has gone through so many owners because no one really found a way to monetize it. Then it does call into question what the conventional wisdom was a decade ago of your .com name being your brand.
There's still a lot of people that actually, you know, when they want something like coupons, they go and type in coupons.com. And I think that domain name is actually worth a lot of money. There's a little bit less of that now because people are so used to finding things through Google. But the domain names are still worth money. You know, you can take a random set of words and just type them in and type .com. And there's probably a page that's parked there with ads.
Is there any reason to think that the change will affect spam sites or phishing sites or in any way affect the security of websites?
Right now, a lot of spam sites tend to gravitate towards kind of the low rent districts like .info, you know, where you can buy a site for $2.
Some guy who owns a .info site is saying, what do you mean? What do you mean low rent? What are you doing to me over here?
You know, it's true, though. You know, it just happened. .biz turned out to be the same thing. They didn't take off. And then, you know, the people that ran them dropped the price. And so then what did you get? You got people that just wanted to, like, create tons and tons of sites. And most of them are selling you herbal Viagra. You know, the problem with spam and security isn't so much the domain names as just the fact that it's easy to make a site these days. And that's great that, you know, anybody can make a site.
Right. The downside is anybody can make a site.
And I think that's actually kind of a cool little possibility that we all might end up with our own domain.
And if I know anything about the internet, .kitten, .cat, .cheeseburger, and .Ron Paul are all going to go in a hurry.
The one I want, which I don't think ICANN would ever allow to happen, is .sucks, .sucks. You know, because how much money could I charge Facebook to buy Facebook.sucks? And if they didn't, you know, it could just be filled with complaints from anybody on the internet.
The internet was invented for a .sucks. That's a great idea. Thank you, Ryan.
Thanks for having me on.
Ryan Singel is a blogger for Wired.com. Coming up, lessons on how to be funny from the New Yorker cartoon editor, and a farewell to the big man. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Mike Pesca. Some say the star of the new documentary Page One inside the New York Times is the newspaper itself. Others say it's David Carr, the media columnist who's part rascal, part sage. I say the real star is the hands-free headset. All the most dramatic moments are punctuated when a journalist rips off their hands-free headset. We also meet at least one journalist who isn't a public figure and whose byline Times readers might not know. That's media editor Bruce Hedlum, who I asked, what did you learn from watching the film?
I learned I roll my eyes far too much. I learned what I look like walking from behind, which is something I frankly could have lived without. You know, honestly, I was generally happy because I looked at how my reporters were acting and more how we managed to coalesce around a story. We tend to look at journalism as the triumph of the kind of dogged individual who, you know, fights all opposition and the establishment in order to get that story out there, but it's a group activity.
No matter what you think of the overall documentary, there were a few moments where we got to see a story, in fact, a few stories essentially being made. So first we have David Carr, who's a media columnist. Here he is in an interview. He's writing a column on Vice magazine. There's the founder of Vice, a guy named Shane Smith, and he's this is a magazine that drips with hipster cred, and Shane Smith is this rough-hewn guy, and he's talking about doing some reporting on Liberia.
Everyone talked to me about cannibalism. And the New York Times, meanwhile, is writing about surfing. And I'm sitting there going, you know what? I'm not going to talk about surfing. I'm going to talk about cannibalism because that f***ed me
up. Just a sec, time out. Before you ever went there,
yeah,
we've had reporters there reporting on genocide after genocide, just because you put on a safari helmet,
sure,
doesn't give you the right to insult what we do. So continue.
Carr interrupting him, essentially sticking up for the New York Times. You think Carr's playing for the cameras when he does that?
No, because I've seen David in similar situations. That's David when you talk about the New York Times that way. There's all kinds of different ways to interview people. David comes in as a character. As he says, he sounds a little weird, and he does sound a little weird. But that's his technique of getting people to talk.
All right. The next piece that I want to talk about is sort of a dog that doesn't bark story. NBC characterized troop movements in Iraq as the end of combat operations.
Tonight, U.S. combat troops are pulling out of Iraq. And Richard, I understand your reporting of this at this hour tonight constitutes the official Pentagon announcement, correct?
Yes, it is. Right now, we are with the last American combat troops.
We've all this video of different departments in the New York Times saying, you know, what is this? Where are they getting this? The documentary shows a lot of discussions, you guys debating it internally.
Did you watch NBC?
Yeah.
Thought it was hallucinatory. Brian Williams says to Richard Engel that your report here from the field amounts to the official Pentagon announcement of the end of combat troops in Iraq.
I don't know that there was, I mean, I'm not trying to be difficult.
No, no, no.
Was there some sort of official?
Tom Shanker in Washington is right now calling the Pentagon again. I mean, I think.
You would think, is the war over?
NBC was saying one thing. And what we are hearing from both the White House and the Pentagon was something else, which is the war officially ends at the end of the month. We will still have 50 to 55,000 combat troops involved. I mean, their primary mission changes, but this felt strangely artificial to us.
Well, the next day, we see a reporter, Brian Stelter, wrote a media decoder column. As combat troops leave Iraq, news media ride along, and his first sentence was, "The combat mission in Iraq doesn't end officially until August 31st, but viewers and readers could be forgiven for thinking it ended tonight."
Mm-hmm.
And so he does talk about how different news organizations decided to play it.
Yes.
And your news organization really avoided phrases like end of combat operations, where some of the other ones, the LA Times and the Post, use that in its headline.
Well, I suppose that happens all the time. It's, you know, there are those certain kinds of journalists who, when asked at the end of their career, their great achievements list all the things they didn't put in the newspaper. I'm not sure this is one of these. I'm glad we did it the way we did. I think the next day there was enough reaction to both NBC and the other newspapers that we could take a more dispassionate look.
The presence of the documentary, has it given you occasion to kind of revisit any of those stories or just even to casually say, well, you know, we got that one right? What kind of conversations have resulted?
Narcissistic as it sounds, some of the parts that affect me are looking at the cutbacks, listening to Richard talk about the business at that point. Richard Perez Pena, who was my newspaper reporter at the time, said nobody was pessimistic enough. You sat around and literally had no idea what was happening. There were articles about the possible demise of the New York Times. There's certainly people writing, cheering on the possible demise of the New York Times. And it was, you know, probably since the days of Howell Raines and Jason Blair and all that, it was probably the most sort of unsure anybody was in the newsroom.
And have you taken any grief from this crack? The occasion was President Obama was visiting Buffalo, and you made a little historical reference to presidents visiting Buffalo.
He's not going to make news today, no.
No.
The last president who made news in Buffalo got shot. Wasn't it McKinley? Let's not put that one in the paper.
I have taken absolutely no grief about that, which is the one thing when I heard I said that, I will say something very curious about the whole film experience. When I saw it, I don't remember saying that in particular. I remember a lot of those conversations under torture. I couldn't have remembered that Andrew was there. He really did blend in after a while, and I just simply don't remember him being there for half those things. So to see it now, it's a little like, oh, God, it's very, very strange. No, I'm worried people in Buffalo are going to make fun of me. I grew up very close to Buffalo. It's very, very close to my heart. The Bills, the Sabres, Flutie over Johnson. So I hope they don't take it personally.
I think there might be a statute of limitations for those sort of things. You know, McKinley's assassination was
I don't think it's, you know, I'm being that insensitive at this point. I think maybe that joke is safe.
Bruce, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bruce Hedlund, media editor of the New York Times. He's featured in the new documentary, Page One, A Year Inside the New York Times. What's funny? K's are funny. W's? Meh. Pants are funny. Sarongs are a little funny. Jodhpurs are trying too hard. Overcoats, not funny. Meh is funnier than eh. Manimal is funnier than Punky Brewster. Okay, we get all that, but what about cartoon captions? Every week, the New Yorker magazine holds a contest where they print a cartoon and ask readers to come up with a caption. And every week, several thousand people do. This outpouring of submissions has been a rich data set for humor researchers at the University of Colorado. Yes, humor researchers who try to answer the question, what makes a joke funny? Their findings? Keep it short and avoid excessive punctuation. Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor for The New Yorker. He runs the contest and he collaborated on the research. But he has his own thoughts on what makes for funny. For instance, this is funny.
There's a knife, you know, one of those gadget knives that mm-hmm. has all those little things, and it all has corkscrews. You're left with a mental picture that is sort of humorous in a way. But if I complete it and tell you it's a French army knife, that's the joke. And I'm doing more research with these guys, Peter McGraw, who's a really good psychologist.
University of Colorado researcher, yeah.
Colorado. You know, I think we both agree, when you're looking at the caption contest, you're looking at something incongruous.
And what else did he find?
He found also that sort of the abstract nature was better. So that if I have a contest, for example, the incongruous picture is a guy is sitting at a desk, but his chair and the thing coming over his head looks like the cap that you get electrocuted with. and he's saying, cancel my 1201. Look, my view is a lot of it can be explained. There's always going to be a part that's not going to be explained.
This leads me to a question. I know humor is supposed to be subjective, but at least in a couple of the cartoons you described, like French Army Knife, we could say that was the right caption.
It is subjective, and I'll show you how. Here's this image of there's two cowboys on horses, except one of them is just in a saddle with no horse at all. So the captions were fairly equally divided between it's a vanishing breed, which is like a pun, and in the end, Ed, all of us are carried along by our delusion. One of the big things that divides people, not absolutely, is how weird do they like the humor? Like, a lot of people need a lot of closure. I get it. See, vanishing breed. The horse isn't there. You got it? Versus, I don't understand, delusions and, you know, whatever.
Right.
An example would be from another caption contest in which there's parrots on everybody's shoulder in a boardroom and the boss is looking at them. And one guy is turning to the other. Now, you got to figure out something like, why a parrot's there? So one solution is one guy turns to the other and says, we've got to think of a better way to record our meetings. We understand that joke. Oh, parrots, they repeat.
That's one of the qualities
that's
of parrots.
That's one of the things. Okay. But then there's another one. This one actually won, although it was fairly evenly divided, which is, shut up, Bob. Everybody knows your parrot's a clip-on. Now, that's much harder to explain.
You get how many submissions a week?
1,000.
1,000.
This is for the regular cartoon.
The regular cartooning. You do not revisit it and stew on it and then say finally after hours, you know what, that was funny.
For the New Yorker, it's more than about funny. We look at it as not only an actual art form, but a conceptual art form. And therefore, you value things like originality. And see, to me also, and I want to make this point, the caption contest cartoons are not real cartoons. They're a game. They're dependent on a four-week delay, on a lot of people submitting. We love them, but they almost never make a point.
And I guess the reason why they're not making a point is that it doesn't come from one artistic vision.
Right.
A cartoon is of a whole. It's one artist's vision. And the ability to tack on a caption that may or may not be funny, I don't know if you agree with this. I bet you a lot of the cartoonists who do this for a living are a little resentful of the cartoon contest.
I think some of them are, and that's why I take pains to explain how different they are. The contest is a game in which we exaggerate incongruity. We make it a real puzzle. So it's very hard to make any other statement. So it is a game, and it's an interesting game because one of the things it shows is the changing face of humor on the internet. Mm-hmm. People want to participate. They like this idea of community that does this. It also shows that I think more than ever, humor is becoming a type of lingua franca, a way that we communicate with each other, almost a necessary way.
Do you think that the skill that you bring to the job as the guy who can select through 4,000 cartoons, you still have the ability to find them funny or that you can recognize what is funny about them or what your audience will think is funny?
I can recognize what is a good cartoon. Believe me, when David Letterman is looking through all the jokes, they are not laughing at the jokes. You know what I mean?
Right.
And what will make them laugh is something so weird and strange is that no one would find funny.
Right. But that's why when you say someone's a comics comic, he's usually really dark and really bizarre.
Right. Really dark and really bizarre. You know, a skeleton walks into a bar and says, barkeep, a beer and a mop. So that takes a little while.
Right.
Most people will say, what? And then if they get it, they'll get it too late. They can't possibly laugh at it.
So some baseball pitchers love these advanced stats, and some say, I don't want to know anything except what's the target and I want to throw the ball.
Yeah.
Just like some comedians love picking it over and would hear this. And some are like, I don't want to overthink it. Do you think the reason that you're drawn to analyzing it and working with these researchers is that not just that you're a funny guy, but that you have the job of having to evaluate thousands of supposedly funny pieces a day?
I think there's two reasons. That's one of them, and also because before I was this, I was an experimental psychologist. Does it help you become funnier? Absolutely not. Is reading Masters and Johnson going to help you better in bed? I don't think so. Might help you better as a cartoonist.
Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor for The New Yorker. The music
music world lost a legendary player last week when Clarence Clemons, the saxophone player in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, died of a stroke at the age of 69. Clemons' sax solos signaled party time in the Springsteen rockers and often painted a melancholy landscape in early Springsteen anthems. Clemons wasn't a great musician, but he was a potent symbol in the E Street Band. While many of his obits mentioned the genuine love between him and Springsteen, few focused on what I call the semiotics of Clarence Clemons. Ann Powers is a music writer for NPR.
Here I am to be your semiotician today.
Well, that's probably too highfalutin for a scruffy guy like Springsteen, but I think it is true that Clemons symbolized some things that Springsteen was trying to convey about his style and his band, right?
Absolutely. Clarence Clemons was the foil for Bruce Springsteen in concert, also the symbol of both friendship, love, the love of music, but very importantly also the embodiment of African-American music, not only on stage and in the show, but in the music itself.
And the cover of Born to Run, the iconic cover of Born to Run, is Bruce leaning on Clarence, not another member of the band, even though Clarence was far from the most important contributor to that album. And in concert, Springsteen did these lengthy intros, and they always built up to a crescendo of Clarence.
Give me a C!
So why is it that Clarence was, as Bruce called him, the secretary of the Brotherhood?
I was reading an interview with Clarence Clemons recently in which he talked about how as a young musician, he was sort of pushed toward playing R&B, soul music, but he felt he was a rocker. Clarence Clemons himself was a crossover artist from the beginning, and I think Bruce Springsteen wanted from the beginning, or at least from Born to Run, to be a guy who transcended genre, and by adding the element of R&B sax through a rock filter that Clarence provided, he made a bigger sound, a sound that went beyond what many people thought of that rock could do at that moment.
And to take it even further than sharing a cover and sharing these great intros, they would frequently share a kiss on the lips on stage.
On stage, in the moment, I think it felt very natural. It was part of the jubilation that surrounds a Springsteen show. But definitely when you look at the photograph, you're a little bit like, wow, that's an intense moment. The scholar Eric Lott once wrote a book called Love and Theft about minstrelsy and about how white performers took from African-American traditions. It's a huge part of the legacy. Some would see the basis of American popular music. Bruce Springsteen kissing Clarence Clemons on the lips, you can see it as a moment in which he is acknowledging in the most intimate way that he is borrowing from those traditions and trying himself to merge with those traditions. So uncomfortable, maybe, but honest, I think so.
But if we want to be really, I don't know, cynical, I mean, if you look at the website Stuff White People Like, number 14 is having a black friend.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, no joke on that. My critic friends and I have talked about that for years, was Clarence Clemons being exploited. But this is not the intention of someone like Bruce Springsteen. He's trying to envision a magical place where those issues that divide us go away. That's the message of his whole live show. And Clarence allowed him to succinctly say that, almost without saying it. I mean, you said he wasn't a great musician. I would argue, as the critic Tom Moon recently argued, that he was a great rock soloist. He had a particular sound, just the same way that another person who integrated a rock band, Slash, the biracial guitarist for Guns N' Roses, has a signature sound. Clarence had a signature sound. You know his sound from the minute you hear that first note. And that's a lot of what being a rock star is about. So I would say he was a great rock player, a great live performer, and part of that is standing for something specific, easy to grasp, and he did that in the E Street Band. We can argue till dawn about whether or not what he stood for is something we should really believe in or really buy. But if you're at a Springsteen concert, And you're letting it all go, and you're letting your critical faculties melt into the floor as Bruce Springsteen persuades you that this is the greatest moment of your life. Part of that, part of the American dream, is racial integration. It may just be a dream still, but that's what Springsteen is giving us and selling us, yes, but also giving us in that moment.
And thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks. That was great.
Ann Power is pop music critic for NPR Music. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Wolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Boat, Sarah Abdurrahman, Asia Bundawi, with more help from Joe Rosenberg and Emily Chin, and edited by Brooke and our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Grannis. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Mike Pasco.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.